This is the No Dogma podcast. I'm Brian Hogan, and this evening from New York, I'm joined by On Freund, VP of Engineering at WeWork. I know I've somewhat mangled your name, so could you please give me the correct pronunciation?
Well, you did it pretty well. The correct pronunciation is On Freund. As I said earlier, I'm asking an Irish guy to say an Israeli name or a German name in an Israeli pronunciation. So given all of these, you did a great job.
Thank you. So can you tell me a little bit about your background, please?
Of course. So as you mentioned, I'm currently heading engineering over at WeWork, where I've been for the past 2 years. I've grown the team quite significantly during my time there, around fivefold, going to double again by the end of the year. Prior to WeWork, I was VP engineering at Handy, joined pretty early on. The company was probably 4 or 5 people. Left it 2 years later with a pretty sizable team. Prior to Handy, I was working for an Israeli startup. This was back in Tel Aviv. I was there for a few years, actually started while still in college, and kind of climbed up the ladder. And just as I moved to New York in a very serendipitous progression of events, the company was acquired by an American company. So everything kind of turned out well. The thing is, after a year or so with the acquiring company, I realized that I have the startup bug in me again, and that's when I joined Handy.
Oops. That growth rate at WeWork, that sounds incredible. You said it grew 5 times, and now you're expecting it to double in the next 6 to 8 months.
Exactly. But WeWork in general is growing at very rapid paces. You know, whether you look at valuations or business in general, the number of locations we have open, the number of members on the platform, all of these are growing, and I'm glad to say faster than our engineering team. So at least we're doing well when it comes to scale.
When I look at WeWork, and I happen to work for a company that's using a WeWork facility, that's not how we met. We met at a CTO summit some months back in New York, but I see WeWork as a large real estate rental company, but I guess that's not how you would see it.
That actually is one way to look at it, and it's not necessarily wrong. WeWork is a real estate company. It's also a technology company, and people think these are mutually exclusive, but I actually disagree. I say it's a real estate company, it's a construction company, it's a design company. It's a technology company, and it wouldn't be what it is without all of these together. When it comes specifically to technology, we're actually running every part of the business. So whether it's sales or marketing, daily operations of building, from the moment we have a building on our sites till the daily management of it, it all flows through our technology. We're what I call a full stack business, where technology is ingrained in every part of the business. Rather than building a product and having some sales team be responsible for selling it.
The topic we're going to largely cover tonight is about the progression of a company, let's say, from a small startup to a large enterprise, and how a person's role, maybe a head of engineering or a CTO, would change as a company grows, because you've experienced that a few times.
Yeah, definitely. The time I spent at SafeEnd back before it was acquired, I've definitely seen pretty rapid growth there. Handy was explosive. From the moment I joined, when the company was 4 or 5 people, till the moment I left 2 years ago with about 200 people, that was amazing growth as well. And then WeWork, which is just a rocket ship. When I joined, I think we were probably like 150. And now we're getting close to 10 times that.
And you've had to deal with, obviously, one of the big challenges is the scale. What does scale mean to you in terms of growth?
So when people think of scale and they talk of scale in a technological context, the first thing they think of is traffic. And that's absolutely true. You know, and especially if you're a social network, if you're Facebook or LinkedIn, scale means traffic. But even with those companies, there are at least 2 other elements that always have to scale. Whether you're scaling traffic or not, if your business is scaling, your team is growing and your code base is growing. So when your team grows, You know, the practices that worked for five people are not necessarily going to work for 50. The structure that worked for five is not going to work for 50. Same goes for code base. What worked for you when you had one little project is not going to work when you have either a huge monolith or a collection of small microservices. Either way, you always need to be on top of your scale and adapt to what's going on.
But for you, let's say, as a head of engineering or VP or a CTO, depending on the company you're in, the skills you'd need for adapting to scale vary enormously because, well, traffic is one set of skills. Managing code base is a different. Managing deployments is different. Users, even employees, you know, the difference between directly managing four or five engineers as opposed to managing 10 or 15 teams of engineers, it's all very different skill sets. How do you yourself combine all of those different things into your own role or your own what you need to learn?
I think the biggest aspect that changes over time is the people aspect that you mentioned. So you don't necessarily need to become a better technologist. Of course, it doesn't help, doesn't hurt, but you don't necessarily need to become one. You do need to become a better people's manager as you grow. And you need to focus on different things when it comes to people. So we've had this sort of an anti-pattern in our industry where the people who are promoted are the best engineers out there. And it's pretty strange because, you know, the fact that, you know, Joe is better than Peter does not mean that, as an engineer, does not mean that Joe is a better manager than Peter. Right. But, you know, being a very meritocratic society, the engineering society that is, we've decided that that's how we promote people. And I think that has caused a lot of people to miscategorize and misunderstand what a true engineering leader actually needs to be. My job is mostly people management. Yes, I am technical. Yes, I've been an engineer for many years. I know my way around code. I can pull off code reviews pretty easily. You know, in a pinch, I can also step in and write new features. But if I'm doing that, it means I'm not being a multiplier for my team. So if I'm writing code, I'm doing 1x of work in my time. If I'm doing something that affects a team of 50 engineers, then I'm doing 50x. The return on investment on my time is 50 times higher. So I think my trade-off is always, how do you keep being somewhat technical? Because you have to be knowledgeable of what's going on. You have to be able to contribute to the discussions. But focus my time on things that have high leverage and affect the entire team, or at least most of it.
Since you brought it up, you're correct. I see it all the time, the wrong people being promoted. And it is difficult because a good engineer deserves a promotion of some sort, but maybe that isn't into managing other people. So what do you do at WeWork when you need a new team lead? And let's say the best person for the job isn't the most senior or isn't the longest tenured or the best coder?
So one of the recent changes I'm seeing in the tech scene, and a very good change, is that we're starting to differentiate between promoting and promoting to management, and understanding that these two do not necessarily need to come together. I think that up until recently, this was sort of a secret known to big companies. So Microsoft had an amazing ladder where you could go from software engineer 1 to 2 and then senior 1 and 2, and I'm probably misquoting the names, but that's the general gist of it. Whereas, you know, if you go to a startup and you were doing a great job, the next step was to lead a team. What we do at WeWork is we actually have two separate paths. So one path you can go through is the management path. If you want to become a manager, the first step in this path would be an engineering lead position in which you're taking over a small team. And then you can continue getting promoted in this path to director of engineering, maybe someday take my job as VP of engineering. But we also have a professional-based promotion path. So as a software engineer, it can also be promoted to a senior software engineer. And that usually has some elements of a multiple in it. But unlike management, it's not strictly required. So you are expected, of course, to mentor junior engineers and make them better. You are expected to lead initiatives that are cross-team. But eventually, you're sort of a celebrated professional. And after being a senior engineer, you could also be a principal engineer, which is someone that, in terms of seniority, is holding a similar rank to director of engineering, just not on the management side. And I think once you have those in place, you realize that people would self-select into the right path. So what I've seen, which is pretty remarkable, is that while people do not always necessarily are good at determining where they are in a specific path, they're really good in self-selecting themselves to the right path. So as you give them those two options, they will say, oh, I actually see myself as more of in a technical progression path, or I definitely wanted to go to management. Of course, they can always change their mind. You can switch from being a engineering lead to a senior software engineer or a principal software engineer if you really want, or vice versa. But in most cases, I've seen that people know where they belong.
I'm going to wind the conversation back a little bit towards what our the original agenda that we spoke about a moment ago was. If you're in, let's say, the role of a small startup and you are in the position of a head of engineering, VP or CTO, we're going to change the conversation and talk about how you progress from being small to medium to large. And this is something that you presented on a few months back. So if you don't mind maybe starting off with how easy it is for a small company to produce change and then how it becomes a little trickier as you get bigger.
Sure. One of the things that I've seen is often misunderstood is the difference between speed and agility. So people always think of these startups as super fast companies. They do everything in lightning pace. And then you have those established companies that are barely moving and you don't see any progress at all. I find this to be a misconception. So those big companies are actually moving way faster than startups, but they're way less agile as well. So it seems like they're not making any progress because they're basically on a set path that they've set, maybe 6 months ago or sometimes maybe even 2 years ago. And they're having a hard time changing it. But the amount of work being produced is immense because not only do you have a full suite of products that you're probably maintaining while building new ones, you also have all sorts of taxes on your work. So things like localization, because maybe you're supporting 10 different languages. Support, maybe you have two of your engineers tied down in support work all day long. And it seems like they're not making any progress, but they're actually making the product better by giving feedback on what's wrong, what needs to be fixed. Sometimes they fix it on their own. So overall, the amount of work being done at a large company is pretty impressive. But then one day someone comes up and says, we should definitely do this. Maybe it's we need to change our course from widgets to what's the other thing that's always mentioned in those examples in textbooks. There's always widgets in some things, right?
I'm drawing a blank. Other widgets, though, yeah.
Yeah, anyway.
Widget 1 to widget 2.
Exactly. So we want to change from manufacturing widget number 1 to widget number 2. And if you do it at a startup and if it makes sense, everybody would be on board in a minute and say, yeah, we definitely want to do widget number 2. That makes so much sense. Let's do it. Starting right now, we're all focused on widget number 2. And then you go to the big company and you say, we want to switch to doing widget number 2. And everyone would be like, well, yeah, that's a great idea. But, we have this release deadline coming up in 3 months that we really need to hit. And of course, after we're done with this, we also need to make sure that it supports 10 different languages. So yeah, we're going to do widget 1. The way I see it, it's probably, in the maybe 2 years from now time frame, we'll start working on widget 2. But yeah, great idea. And it might seem like it's slow, but it actually, in a way, it kind of makes sense, right? This is what disruption theory is all about.
It is very difficult for a large company. I was just saying to you before we started, I was at a presentation by Adrian Cockcroft, former CTO of Netflix. And he was giving the example that a lot of the banks are very, very slow to make changes. But Capital One seemingly is bucking that trend. They're into the cloud. They are trying to produce things very rapidly, ship them, get them out to customers. And it's beginning to show in their front ends. And it's also beginning to show in, I suppose, their revenue. So it seems that big companies, once they've maybe changed their mindset, they can do these things. But I imagine, I can understand it is much, much harder. There's a lot more to lose for a large bank, like a Bank of America, to suddenly move to the cloud would be almost unthinkable, I imagine.
Definitely. And, you know, I don't want to come off as this management consultant for big companies, which I definitely am not qualified to do. But I will say that there are ways to do it. And it probably has to do with breaking up the company into smaller pieces that operate independently and are able to iterate quickly like a startup. But I guess we'll get to that later when we talk about the different patterns of teams that I've seen.
I've seen that same thing too. I know some large companies have even set up a campus outside of their main facility because they didn't want the influence of the sort of the slow progression. Oh, what are you doing? No, you shouldn't be doing it that way. They would split them off, move them to a different building. I can't remember which company it was, but it was one of the big tech companies. They moved to the Cambridge Innovation Center here in Boston to just get that separation.
Yeah, we're seeing that at WeWork with large companies getting a small team together, setting them up at WeWork rather than the company's main campus, and setting them loose on the transition to Widget 2.
So we've talked a little bit about very small companies, so the startup, and we've talked about the very large corporation. But when you're transitioning from being that small, agile, / fast, / whatever you want to call it, to being a more growth stage startup, What's different?
I think the first thing that becomes evidently different is communication. All of a sudden, you need a whole lot of it. And there's a difference between being four guys in a room and assuming that anything that's known by one person is known by everyone. All of a sudden, you need to make sure that knowledge is flowing. And one of the examples I gave at my talk a few months ago when we met was what happens when you have a production bug at a small startup compared to a more established growth stage tech company. So if you're a small startup, what you'd probably do is you'd immediately solve the bug, or at least maybe not solve it, but at least have some workaround in place in no time. The next thing you do is let everyone know, hey, this thing happened. You don't really need to do much because by then everyone probably knows. And then you start strategizing the longer term fix for it. So I gave the example of a car race driver. And what they would do if something's wrong is they would course correct immediately. They would let the pit team know so that the next time they make a pit stop, the team could actually put a longer term fix in place. But if you're a growth stage company, the first thing you would do is actually communicate. And this is where I said it's more like a commercial airline pilot. The first thing you do is you alert everyone, hey, we have this problem, just so you know. Because in many cases, there are actually people out there dealing with this problem, not even knowing that it exists. So you alert all the stakeholders. Then you have sort of a war room, which could be a chat channel if you're using something like Slack or HipChat. Could sometimes be a Google Doc that everyone is working on together. And then after you fix it, you'll also have a postmortem. I think a best practice is to hold those as sort of blameless and transparent to make sure that you're really capturing all the learnings. But these things are becoming so important right now with a big team, and they meant nothing when the team was four people. Who needs those postmortems? Or, you know, it's just going to take us 2 hours to work on it now, and we all remember exactly what happened, and we can probably recite it in our sleep and make sure it never happens again.
So then the growth stage, you're saying communication is key. potentially documentation. So you're getting slightly more formal, it feels like, compared to the startup where you're all in the one room and everything is just, oh, hey, let's throw the file onto production and fix things.
You're definitely becoming more formal. The trick, I think, and this is a realization I had a couple of months ago, I think the trick is to always keep your organizational maturity just slightly behind your real size. As long as you do that, it always feels like a startup. You'll never feel like you're bogged down by red tape and bureaucracy.
Interesting. Then the final type of company we're going to cover is the very mature tech company. So I suppose the large IBMs, for want of a better term, who've been established and around for many, many years. How do they deal with change and scale?
So that becomes similar to what I said earlier with the widgets and the example of, oh yeah, we'll do it in 2 years. It doesn't have to be like that, of course. But the idea is, first of all, communication, which we mentioned earlier, is key at a growth stage startup, is becoming even more critical now. And it's also becoming impossible to let everyone know what's going on. So you're not only focused on communication or focused on who should I communicate this to and when. So what is the, on the one hand, minimal amount of team members that need to know about this to get it done or to know what's going on, but on the other hand, keep it in a way transparent so that everyone that wants to know about it can. So you need to differentiate between who needs to know about something and who wants to know about something. Really make sure that the first group kind of gets a push and the second group can always get it with a pull. But then I think the real key at this stage is understanding how to break up your teams to make this happen. So in a way, as a CTO, as a VP engineering, as an engineering leader, your main leverage point or your main strategy for affecting things is determining what are the communication channels that are happening within my organization. And the way to do it is controlling the team structure or org structure.
And that leads us very nicely onto Conway's Law. So before we get into it, I'll just say that I don't remember hearing of Conway's Law prior to the day at the event where there was maybe 15 or 20 speakers. And by the end of the day, there had been three or maybe even four people who were talking about Conway's Law and Simon Wardley. So if you don't mind, can you go over a little bit of what Conway's Law is?
Sure. I had the luxury at the conference of being actually the first speaker to bring it up. So that also meant that I had to accurately quote it. So what Melvin Conway said, and by the way, he has no, as far as I know, no relation to Conway's Game of Life. That's a different Conway. What Melvin Conway said is organizations which design systems are constrained to produce designs which are copies of the communication structures of these organizations. What it means is that you're shipping the org structure, as I think it was Microsoft CEO who said this a few weeks ago. The internal org structure that you have is what you'll see in the product. And the law is using the word constrained, and I think a lot of people kind of get hung up on this word and treat it as a constraint. Oh my God, I can't do anything because my organization looks like this. The way I see it, it's an opportunity. So if you're managing a team of 50, that actually becomes your main tool in the toolbox. Changing the org structure affects the product, affects what you're shipping, affects your architecture. And if you think about it, if by changing teams I can affect the product, then if I want a specific, let's say, architectural pattern for my product, maybe I can apply the same architectural pattern to the team and it will work. And it sounds crazy at first, but it actually works. And then you realize that a lot of the patterns that you know from your technical work actually apply to people as well.
What I've seen in companies is that when, let's say, you're doing some very large refactoring, maybe restarting a V2 of something, companies will often create teams around small subsets of the functionality that's going to be in the product. But those small teams aren't the only thing. Then you need a small support team. Then you need a small QA team. Then you need a small management team. So all of a sudden, what you've done in code turns into the organization that you end up with.
Exactly.
Yeah. So exactly. It seems to be able to flow both ways.
Definitely.
The next thing we were going to talk about a little bit about were the team patterns that come out of this. And then the first one that you want to talk about was the big fat monolith.
Right. So we all know this, and microservices are becoming, or not becoming, they're continuing to trend as the hot topic for computer architecture, software architecture. It actually applies to teams as well. And you know, it seems obvious, yeah, if I have a really big team, then that means that I have a monolithic team. But sometimes the monolith is not clearly visible. So the fact that you don't see just one team does not necessarily mean that you're not a monolith. So one of the quotes I really like is by David Brady. He put this on Twitter. If one service dies and your whole system breaks, you don't really have service-oriented architecture. You have a monolith whose brain has been chopped up and stuck in jars. And that applies to teams as well. So if everything you do requires cross-communication, constant cross-communication between teams, you probably still have one team that's been chopped up.
But it is very difficult to move away from that. Like I know companies that are trying to move to microservices, and what they're saying, a friend of mine was saying to me, it's not so much the technology and it's not the programming, it's the organization and the communication between the different microservices. You know, they have widget A microservice that somehow relies on widget B microservice, and they didn't mean to have that, but that's what they ended up with. So then if A breaks, well, then B is down too.
Exactly.
And again, going back to the presentation by Adrian Cockcroft, it seems like an enormously difficult thing to fix. And the impression I got from him when he presented, and I hope I'm not misrepresenting or misquoting him, it sounded like Netflix struggled with that too when they started. I wouldn't be too surprised.
I wouldn't be too surprised at all. I would probably say that almost any team doing microservices has at some point struggled with the wrong type of dependency or the wrong direction of dependency. It's especially evident, I think, if you're going microservices from the get-go rather than going monolithic and then based on your learnings breaking into services. Always difficult, whether it's people or whether it's code components. If you have the dependency going in the wrong direction, it's, you know, eventually you'll have to break it. But while it's still there, it's going to cause you a lot of bottlenecks and a lot of sleepless nights, perhaps.
But even if you still have the problem of a brain split into many jars, the fact that you have many jars means that you're independently deployable. And that alone is an enormous advantage over where you used to be. So I can still see that if you don't get to the full, you know, the glory of microservices, just getting a little bit along the way is a huge improvement for most companies.
Definitely. You know, we're pragmatists and it's all a spectrum. As the saying goes, only a Sith deals with absolutes. So, you know, there is no monolithic versus microservices. There is a spectrum that gets you from one to the other. And there are many, many points along the way.
What's the next type of team you wanted to discuss after the big fat monolith?
The next type of team is actually sort of a pet peeve of mine because I see it so often. And I think while it sometimes makes sense, it pretty soon grows unwieldy. And that is the MVC team.
So is that model view controller?
Exactly. Okay. Exactly. Just like the model view controller, that architecture that you will see in many JavaScript frameworks or in Ruby on Rails, you have
.NET too.
And .NET, exactly. You'll see three teams. The view team or the front end team is doing the UI. You have the back end team or the model team, and they're working on the business logic. And then you have the controller, which is sort of an applications team, and they're usually responsible for packaging the software if it's a sort of a shrink wrap kind of product, or pushing tying releases together, adding application level features on top of it, like security and logging. These teams could be great in the beginning, and you might feel like you're moving really quickly. The problem is that just like the real MVC in code, at some point you realize that even simple changes require modifications in three places. So if you're working on a small feature, at some point you need the work of these three teams to integrate. And that could become really time consuming. So in one of my companies, we've had integrations, we've had MVC teams, we've had integrations that might even take up to a week. And then when we decided to restructure the organization into product-based teams instead of MVC teams, all of a sudden integrations took 30 minutes. And that, by the way, was shrink wrap software.
The next type of team you want to discuss is called the infrastructure team.
Right. The infrastructure team is a very interesting trade-off. So I definitely think that it makes sense in many ways, but it has a lot of disadvantages. So you've got a team that's able to work on stuff that no other team could actually work on because that's their mandate. But then everyone becomes super dependent on it. So like any component, if everyone is depending on it, that means that component cannot be down. Same goes for that team. That team cannot be down. And that means they need to be on call all day long. And if it's, you know, a two-person team, then they need to somehow work out shifts of 24/7. That sounds pretty tough. You definitely don't want to go there. So I think the key is, I definitely like the infrastructure team. I think the key is to make sure that other teams are able to step into it. So the infrastructure being built by those teams is not something that only they know, but it's actually something that all the teams know, but they were the ones initiating. And anyone in any team should be able to step into your infrastructure and make changes as needed. And in the same way that in code you would decouple or introduce some redundancy, you would do the same with your infrastructure. And the last thing, by the way, you want to hear is a quote like, oh yeah, this collection class was written by the infrastructure team a year ago and no one has touched it since and we don't really know what to do with it. The person who wrote it might have even left.
But that happens so often in companies, especially with things like stored procedures, you know, untouchable stored procedures I've seen in companies. We don't know what it does. We know it does the right thing. We're leaving it alone.
I've had the luxury of not having to deal with stored procedures in my career at all. I believe they're evil.
Then the final team we want to discuss, what was that one?
So the final team...
Team structure, excuse me.
I wouldn't even say team. It's sort of another pattern. So if you're looking at background jobs in software, you usually have queues. And in the beginning, you usually start with one type of worker that can handle any type of job, right? So that is actually the most efficient way to handle this, right? Any job is immediately picked up as soon as there's a worker available. You add more workers, more jobs get picked up. This is great. But then at some point, you realize that you're actually sacrificing predictability and real timeliness for efficiency. So let's say you have two types of jobs. One is this long-running job that is churning logs and could take hours. And another one, let's take something from WeWork's domain. Another one might be sending a text message to the to one of our members, letting them know that there's they have a conference room booking coming up. So the last thing you want is for this log churning job to take up all of your workers, and for the text message job to not go out in time and go out an hour later when it's too late. So at some point you realize, hey, I actually need some predictability around here. Maybe I need some dedicated workers for the text message jobs, or maybe I need dedicated workers for the log churning jobs, so that if something goes wrong in one, the other is not affected. So you're sacrificing efficiency. You're gaining predictability over what's going to happen and when. And the same thing happens with teams. So at some point you realize, oh, this part of the product, we actually need to know what our progress rate on it is, and we need to ensure that we're making progress every week. And then you realize, okay, maybe that part needs a dedicated team. Maybe the queue that this team is working on is a separate queue than everyone else. Whereas in the beginning, you might have had all teams work off the same queue and split up the teams just to make sure that you can control every team, because at some point, you know, the number just grows too large. So that's another interesting example of how architectural patterns or architectural design patterns work for teams and individuals as well.
Within WeWork, what kind of team pattern do you implement?
We have product-based teams, or I would actually say goal-based teams. So every team has a goal, and the goal could be very very metricized or very specific, as in change this number from X to Y. It could also be more vague, like build a billing system that enables us to scale to twice our size or 10 times our size. So not only are the teams different in the goal that they have, they're actually different in the types of goals that they have. But overall, every team looks the same, and every team is cross-functional. It includes engineers, it includes product people, designers, potentially support people, all working towards the same goal.
You have been through a number of startups and enormous growth, so you've seen these things and you're very experienced at that. But let's say some company that's at the growth stage, you might have a bunch of what were junior engineers who are now facing this big fat monolith or whatever it happens to be. Is it reasonable to expect an engineer to be able to fix this problem?
Well, that's exactly where a manager shines. So we talked in the beginning about the difference between being a great individual contributor and climbing up the ladder of professionalism and being a manager, and the fact that being a great engineer does not equate being a great manager and vice versa. Finding ways to break up this monolith is in many ways the task of sort of a manager and a senior engineer together. To come up with a solution there. And in many ways, I think the trick is finding the small triggers to get it done. So I'm a big believer in handling tech debt through features. So let's say that you have this piece of code that has an enormous type of debt. Let's say it's a crazy dependency on a third party that you can't get rid of. There are two ways to go about it. You can say, all right, let's stop everything and work on this for, you know, 2 months and fix this thing. And the other way would be to kind of go by the Boy Scout rule and say, every time someone touches this piece, they leave it in a better state than what it was. And pretty soon you'll have a feature that has something to do with this piece. And you'll tweak it and you'll change it a bit and you'll reduce the dependency on this third party. And then a week later, you might have another feature in this area, and you'll make another change. And eventually, you'll realize 3 months down the line that even though you never budgeted those 2 months where everyone is working on it, you've actually made half of the progress that you need, and you haven't really slowed down on your day-to-day work. This exact story actually happened to us at WeWork, and we did exactly this. So we had this plan on how we're going to fix this issue with 3 months. And then we looked at it and we said, oh, that actually makes no sense whatsoever that we just, you know, stop everything and deal with it. And 6 months later, we just realized, hey, we don't have this problem anymore. We never really had this as a feature, but we made sure whenever we touch this to change it. And so far, so good, and it seems like it's been working well. So it's been a year since those 6 months in which we fixed it, and it's pretty amazing to see that this dependency has actually been removed from the product.
It's nice as well that in a scenario like that, a lot of companies would, as you say, have to come up with a plan, potentially stop work that's going to bring in revenue, and therefore have to get maybe C-level buy-in to say, you know what, the engineers are not available for building products X. We're going to have to fix product A, even though it's still bringing in the money. So that is a very nice success story. But I imagine as well, it requires a certain degree of experience or talent that perhaps some companies just don't have.
Well, I mean, you can say that about anything, right?
True,
anything
I know. It is a bit of a throwaway, unfortunately.
Of talent that not every company might have. But I think it's mostly about understanding, you know what, I would even generalize it a bit more. I would say that a huge chunk of problems in architecture and in team structure could be solved just by breaking the work into smaller chunks. And if you find a way to get quick wins every week or so, or every day or so, you'll see that you actually get stuff done, and those 6 months plans are actually coming together in those small wins. It's also very addictive. I don't know. There's some scientific claim that I never bothered to check that it actually releases endorphins, and it's sort of like exercise, and you get addicted. But then if you stop having those wins for a week, then you know, you might not want to come back to it, in the same way that if you stop exercising for a week, then the next day you're like, yeah, maybe I won't go to the gym again today. I'll go tomorrow. But then when you're really into it, you can't think of missing a day.
True, true. The peaks and the troughs, I guess.
Exactly.
Any final notes before we wrap up for tonight?
First of all, this was great. I had a great time, and thanks for inviting me. Final notes.
I presume you're hiring as a company with that growth rate you described?
Always, always.
So is that New York, Manhattan, or where?
We're hiring actually in two different locations. We're hiring both in Manhattan. Our office is in Chelsea. Our office, by the way, is at a WeWork location. We eat our own dog food. We're also hiring in Tel Aviv. We have a product center there as well. So if you're an engineer or a product manager or a designer or anything in tech in Tel Aviv or in New York, or wanting to move to Tel Aviv or in New York, you want to join one of the fastest growing companies in the world and work on some really amazing stuff with us, we'd love to hear from you.
Super. Unfreund. Thank you very much for your time this evening. I hope I didn't mangle your name.
No, it was close enough. It was the pronunciation is Unfreund.
Super. Thank you again.
Thank you.
The opening music was a return by Nisi23 from the album 11 and 12, and the closing music was Epoch by John Luke Hefferman from the album Production Music 2.